Okay, so we'll go ahead and start. Just to fortify ourselves, we'll start with the Buddha's mantra, and then a little bit of silence, and I'll set a motivation, and then we'll do a teaching on the chapter that I'll introduce. So we'll start with the Buddha's mantra. Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha Tayata Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha Tayata Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha. Come back to your breath. So by way of motivation, I'd like to introduce part of the Buddhist worldview, which is that as a human being, as a living creature, as a sentient being, we have an amazing capacity and potential. It's said that our mind is like the sky. And any of the disturbances that come in are like clouds in the sky. They're not part of it. So our mind, by nature, has this kind of purity, you might say. Freedom, free, completely not embedded with all the mental disturbances that what we call afflictions, which color our days and make our lives less than ideal. So when the Buddha first taught, he really was trying to help us to be aware of what our situation was, not to distract ourselves, but to actually look straight honestly at our situation and then see that it had causes. And that there were remedies to these causes and a way, a path, mental states actually that we could cultivate because we have this amazing potential to overcome all of our difficulties. And not only do we as an individual have that capacity, but every living being, even these stink bugs, have this capacity. And so, as we delve into this particular chapter, let's set our intention to see the ramifications of this chapter in terms of our daily experience in our life, our interconnectedness with others, and try to be able to hold our potential in mind, and also the potential of all those around us, and see how we can learn to contribute to the well-being of everyone that we meet, every living creature. And from this Buddhist perspective, we do this by cultivating our good qualities, uprooting and completely getting rid of our unwholesome qualities. And all this is based upon this mind that is clear like the sky by its very nature. So we're studying this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think. And we don't really assume that you've read the chapter. I'm not. And so we're on chapter, the verse 22 now of 37 verses. And so most of this book is quite accessible. You don't need much of a background to understand. This chapter is a little bit of an exception. So the previous chapters were, and actually I'd say this verse and the next two verses are probably the difficult philosophical chapters of the book, and the other ones are very accessible. So don't get thrown off if you walk out of here today kind of like, I wonder what that's about. It's only three verses of 37. So anyway, that's my little introduction. A lot of the previous and other chapters are talking about this potential that we have in terms of becoming actually a Buddha. And we call this bodhicitta, this wish to become a Buddha in order to help and alleviate the suffering of others. So when they talk about bodhicitta, there's this all these kind of daily life conventional aspects to it, but then there's also this ultimate aspect to it. And that's kind of the topic today. When we're looking at this, really what is the ultimate nature, we call it emptiness, meaning that how things, emptiness means that they're empty of something. So we have to figure out what that something is that they're empty of, the ultimate nature of reality. And so, as you could see from the meditation this morning, we have this way that things appear to us, and then we have, which is kind of what we might call the conventional day-to-day reality that we experience, right? And then there's the underlying ultimate way that things exist, and which is like the deepest way that things exist. So we call that ultimate reality. And so what we're trying to do as we go along our path is we're trying to be able to look beyond the superficial and conventional way that things appear and try to see their deeper nature. And that's what this particular verse is about. So I'll read the verse, and then I want to spend... It's kind of hard to actually understand the verse until you have a certain amount of background, so I want to kind of try to develop that. So the verse is, whatever appears is your own mind. Your mind from the start was free from fabricated extremes. Understanding this, do not take to mind inherent signs of subject and object. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. So this is a verse that's actually, if you know what it's talking about, it's telling you how to meditate on the deepest nature of reality. And sometimes in this particular chapter, and it's often described as a space-like emptiness. And so it's not meaning you're spaced out, okay? So that we'll get to in a little bit, like why they have that analogy. But just to understand the context for this verse is talking about what you're doing when you're on the cushion, you have developed the ability to concentrate your mind fully, and now you've had a lot of teachings and understanding, and now you're going to sit there and single-pointedly focus on this emptiness of what? What is it things are empty of? And that's what we want to try to develop here. They're empty of inherent existence. And what the heck does that mean? Well, you can see from the discussion, the meditation this morning, that our mind just kind of sees things in a certain way, and they appear. Things appear to like exist just on their own. This is a gong, this is that. And we don't actually really usually even question that appearance. So, and it turns out that things don't really exist the way they appear that way. And this is a really, there's technical terms for all of this, but basically being able to see what is it you're conceiving that they aren't is really kind of an important starting point and hard, maybe, it's actually the hardest part of the whole meditation is to get to that. But just trying to understand what we're talking about intellectually first is what we're trying to do here. So this is a meditation session where you're focusing on the ultimate truth, which is the deepest mode of existence. It's the deepest way that people and things, phenomena, exist. So that's what that verse is about. So I really am not so interested in giving the technical terms for things as much as explaining, you know, there are some technical terms in this chapter, but really what I'm hoping that we get out of today is just a feeling for what the heck are they talking about in this verse. Okay, so in Buddhism, there's a lot of philosophy and this and that that talks about the relationship between how things appear to us on a conventional level and how they actually exist. And so, how do they exist? Well, we actually talked about that this morning, but we don't really penetrate the meaning of that, so it just kind of like goes over our head, actually. They actually exist dependently, like that shirt. If you actually take that meditation and even intellectually just draw it out, you're probably going to get to a place where you can't not, where you're going to include everything. Like, how did that cotton grow to make that cloth? Well, you needed the sun, you needed the soil, you needed the, you know, it gets to the point where everything's included. And even young children can understand this. I know of a person who taught these kind of ideas of dependent arising to elementary school kids, and they got it. You know, like, oh, this sweater, there was the sheep, there was the farmer, there was the truck, you know. That's the level that, you know, that they could see very easily. And so, of course, we will. But to penetrate these things to the place where they're not just kind of like, oh, yeah, right, on to the next thing, but where they actually impact us, that's what we end up doing in these in meditation. We get it to the place where we understand these things so that they're impacting our understanding completely of ourselves and of everything that we see to a place that actually can bring us complete freedom from all of our problems and help us to actually have a greater understanding and compassion for others. So this is, you know, our goal, I would say. So I'd like to introduce a little bit about this topic from a different book. And I'm going to read a little excerpt from a book called Appearance and Reality, which is kind of what we're talking about here, right? The appearance and the reality. This is by a friend of ours, a college professor who teaches people who aren't interested in Buddhism, so he's really good with words. So he says, "What is real?" Because the title of this chapter is, "Who Am I?" And actually these kind of end up coming to the same point, as you'll see. So he wrote, "When Buddha awoke from the dream, we still dream," which is this veil of the ordinary appearances to our mind, right? So when the Buddha awoke from the dream, we still dream. He saw the ultimate reality of things just as they are. This illusoriness of ordinary appearances is implied by the very title, Buddha, which means one who has awakened. And yet motivated by concern for our welfare, he worked within the world of conventional appearances, using conventions of language to point us in the right direction. You see, we understand the world in a certain way. Somebody can't just come in and completely turn you upside down, and it's just not going to work for you. So the Buddha was a very skillful teacher. He taught using the conventions of the world as people understood them, meeting the level of each person that he met, guiding them in the right direction. So the Buddhist philosophy attempts to clarify the philosophical and intellectual content of this core Buddhist story. It's a story that turns on a perennial human theme, the doubleness of the world. There are shifting appearances and conventions, the manners and traditions of the vast and diverse world. And then there's the mystery of things just as they are, the sheer reality. So this is, I think, something that we can understand very easily. Look at manners. In one culture, Tibetan culture, sticking out your tongue at somebody is like a kind of endearment. For us, it's an insult, right? Or, you know, there's just so many cultural differences that have no, there's, you know, they're just how it's defined in a certain culture, right? This is the thing that in the meditation this morning when they were talking about the dependent arising, we labeled it a shirt, right? We label this a good manners, we label this bad manners. We label things all the time. And how it appears to us, like the example that's really in my mind quite strongly right now is this, a young man who just got sentenced to life without parole for murder. So think about that when you read that in the news. What do you see? Well, one person sees their brother. Another person sees their son. Another person sees a murderer. Another person sees a human being in tragic circumstances. What appears to your mind when you see that, right? We have the label. It's what the courts have to do. Life without parole. Boom. But what is it that appears to your mind there? You see what I'm getting at a little bit? A shirt is a nice example, but what is it that's not going to affect your day so much as how are we treating each other? Who's a jerk and who's your friend? You know, and who do you not care about because they're a stranger? You know, this is why we study this topic, because we want to develop ourselves spiritually, right? But there are these shifting appearances and conventions, the manners and traditions of the world that are vast and diverse. And then there's the mystery of things just as they are, the sheer reality. And yet we cannot find this reality anywhere else but right here in the midst of shifting appearances. So it's not like we're going to, when we talk about the ultimate nature, the emptiness of things, we're not going to like some holy land two clouds over. You know, that's not it. Everything that we see, the table, my body, my mind, this, everything has this lack of existing by its existing inherently, existing independent of all other factors. So it's not like when we discover the nature of reality that we need to go two clouds over and turn left. Okay, it's all here around us. We have to learn to penetrate it by our listening to the teachings, understanding, contemplating, discussing them, which is why we have days like today to understand things more deeply and share our shared, we learn a lot from each other, and then taking it to the cushion in meditation so that it can actually penetrate the core of your being. You know, it's when things stay at just kind of an intellectual level, which like that meditation she led this morning, for the longest time when I would do that meditation, it was just like right here, like, okay, a house has all these parts. Nice. Okay, on to the next thing. You know, and that's not going to change how you're living in the world. That's not penetrating it. So that's why we have meditation. Okay, then he goes on with this quote. Buddhist philosophers call this doubleness the two truths, conventional and ultimate truth. in exploring this, we are looking over the shoulders of Buddhist thinkers as they grapple with the basic question, what is real? And this is not an idle intellectual question, but a matter that cuts to the heart of our practice in life, how we're living our lives. If clear analysis of reality reveals no substantial personal self, then who are we anyway? That's how we got the chapter of this book, Who Am I? Does people kind of get what we're going after here? Not only is there no inherent existence of this gong, but even the person that we think we are, our personal identities, these lack a real substance to them. So, if our analysis is clear and we find there's no substantial personal self, then who are we anyway? If analysis of reality shows no absolutely established moral standards, then how are we going to be guided in living with one another? You know, you can't just throw everything out. That would be like chaos. And then from a Buddhist standpoint, it's going to lead you down a very unhappy road to misery. So what we are trying to do here is trying to understand the ultimate nature of reality within the context of conventional reality. We have to understand, like as Venerable always says, they lean on each other. One depends on the other. It's not like you're throwing out one thing, but we're maybe more penetrating how it really is. So, if you look at it this way, there must be some sense in which conventional truths do not really exist. But on the other hand, there's some way that we need to uphold these conventional appearances, right? They have some legitimate status. And that's the case in the Buddhist teachings as well. We're not throwing out saying these things are non-existent. You could take that to, if you take that, go down the wrong road and you take that to a certain extreme, you'll throw out some of the basic teachings in the Buddhist worldview, basically like karma. If you can't find a person who's suffering, then who cares? You know, if you don't have any consequences to your actions, then why worry about it? You know, and this is kind of what why we always try to keep in mind these two things. They're leaning on each other, the ultimate nature of reality and the conventional nature of reality. They depend on each other. So I'd like to develop this a little better. So if you go to a place where you can't still establish what we talked about this morning, that things arise dependently, and you just think things don't exist, like, okay, when you look through for the nature of reality in meditation, the way we're talking about it, you're not actually going to find that inherently existent person, because it doesn't exist. But that doesn't mean nothing exists. It's like this. If you were listening to music, your ear is listening to music, but does your eye see the music? No, your eyes don't see music. They might see the printed page, but your ears hear, your eyes see. Your eyes can't hear the music. Does that mean the music doesn't exist when you're playing in the CD? No, it just means you don't have the right tool to look at it. Right? And this is kind of what's happening when you're meditating on the nature of reality. You're using a kind of mind that what's going to appear to it is the ultimate reality. And what does that actually mean? It means something that appears how it exists. And how it exists? It exists like as an absence. So one thing that works for me in understanding this is like, kind of bringing it back to like a metaphor or an example that you can kind of sink your teeth into a little bit better. What if you were, do you think there's an elephant in this room? Anyone think there's an elephant in this room? No, that elephant doesn't exist in this room. But what if I said, I think there's a snake in this room? Now, that's a little harder to find. Or if I said, there's a tarantula in this room. Now we've got to look around a little bit, right? We've got to convince ourselves that it's not there, that it doesn't exist. And we can't do that by just, if I say to you, you know, well, just look over there, and if you decide there's no tarantula over there, is your fear going to go away? No, because you haven't looked over there, you know what I mean? So this is kind of the way you kind of have to learn to hold these things, is what we do in this kind of meditation is we have to see, I'm kind of conflating ideas here, so maybe I better straighten myself out. Okay. What we want to do is we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's put it that way. We want to make sure that when we learn about the nature of reality, that we keep in mind that things arise dependently. Some things exist. Some things are non-existent, like the example we often use is like, a mustache on a turtle? There's no mustaches on turtles, right? That's non-existent. But there is a lot of things that appear to us in a certain way. They're there and they function in a certain way, like suffering people. You can't actually, when you do this analysis with ultimate analysis, you can't find the person. But does that mean there's no person there who's suffering? Does that mean you throw everything out? This is how things kind of, you have to remember that one's leaning on the other. Is that point, are you getting the point, kind of? So this thing about the music, I think, is one good way to think about it. When we do ultimate analysis, we're looking with a certain kind of mind. What is it looking for? It's looking for how things exist ultimately. And how do they exist ultimately? They exist how they appear. And what is it you're going to find? You're going to find an absence of them existing how they appear when you're looking with your conventional mind that sees this jerk over here and this murderer over here and this gong over here and this clock here. Do you follow that at all? Yeah, good. That's as far enough. You're getting it a little bit. So the safety net here is to always come back to this dependent arising. Always come back to that, you know, and that kind of analysis really makes the mind fertile to understand these other ways of looking at things. If you look at all the things, the way things, how things depend on things, you know, just think about it, like, what is real? Okay, that was his basic question. Okay, here's my example that I always use for myself. I'm in a certain mood. Okay, let's say I'm in a bad mood. And I come in and I play my answering machine. This has actually happened to me, and this is where I started getting this. And what do I hear? I hear a voice that's like, argh. And then I go back and I'm in a good mood and I listen to the same message. And what do I hear? I hear it completely differently. This is like how we always say hindsight's 20/20, how your mind is clouded by anger. You're actually exaggerating the negativeness of something, like 80% they've decided. So when my mind's angry and I listen to that answering machine, jerk. Because my mind is clouded. This is what we always come to when we say hindsight's 20/20. Our mind was clouded with a kind of ignorance and delusion, and maybe whatever we added on top of it, maybe like anger, or maybe like exaggerating, like falling in love with somebody and only seeing all their good qualities, and then about a month later, oh, well, I guess they have a few faults too. You know, this is the mind of delusion. And so this is what in the Buddhist worldview, when we talk about how things appear and how they exist, well, that's a certain level, but let's talk about our day-to-day life. How things appear, just, you know, how people appear to us, always shifting sands of whether we feel friendly towards them or having difficulty with them. What's that based on? It's based on a kind of ignorance inside of ourselves. And it's a similar kind of ignorance to what we want to uproot in order to understand the nature of reality. I think it's quite helpful to understand that our capacity, so there's this kind of ignorance, an active ignorance that's so active that we don't even know it's there. like when I listen to that answering machine and I'm not aware that my mind is deluded because I'm just right in the midst of it all, on automatic, my awareness level, my discriminating awareness is like, it appears this way, And so we have the ability, though, hindsight's 20/20, right? We have the ability, even in our day-to-day things, to look back. Why did she title this book this way? Don't believe everything you think. Why? Because our perceptions and our thoughts often are inaccurate, and we believe them in the midst of it all, right? We get ourselves in a lot of trouble this way. So, in this tradition that we're in, we want to develop ourselves spiritually, including this amazing ability we have to develop this kind of discriminating wisdom. And so when we talk about, I want to kind of segue back to this verse a little bit. When we talk about withdrawing from that kind of ignorance, we're not talking about going into some spaced out state. When they talk about space-like emptiness during equipoise, this is how the chapter says it. It says, at least in Geshe Tekchok's book, which is a commentary on the same verse, how to meditate on space-like emptiness during equipoise, which means how to meditate on this kind of ultimate nature of reality when your mind is single-pointedly concentrating on it. That's what that means. It doesn't mean when they say it's space-like that you space out. That's not what they're talking about. Because if that was the case, and this is one of the things I love about Guy Newland, if enlightenment were simply a matter of stopping the stream of conceptual thinking, then a hammer blow to the head ought to bring some profound wisdom. I can understand that. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to, instead of backing away from the tangle of this, the way our thought is so, mixed up with these things, we're trying to actually see things how they are, and we have to use our logic in order to do this. And so we start with logic, and then we get it to a place where we actually transcend logic, and we can see things actually directly with the kind of mind that probably most of us don't have too much experience with, but we all have the capacity for, is to penetrate these things at a very deep level with a discriminating, searching awareness. I would call it that. Okay. So when we talk about, so we've kind of identified now conventional truth and ultimate truth, conventional reality, ultimate reality. And these aren't like two kinds of perspectives on the world. Sometimes we can think of it that way. They're not like two levels of reality. They're actually two types of truth. They're objects that we can know, that exist and that we can know. They're actually objects. And so that's kind of different than how we oftentimes think about the word truth, I think. We think of it as a concept more, a lot of times. Or, I don't know, a lot of times I think we think of things as a place. I'm going to go to Nirvana, like drive your car and follow the GPS thing, and there you are. That's not it. So the word truth, in the way we're talking about here, it's talking about for ultimate truth. Well, the word truth actually means, what it really means is an object that exists as it appears. So ultimate truth, really, that is the case. But conventional truth isn't a truth at all, because it doesn't exist how it appears. We use the word, but it's really, it's a truth for, like you might say, truth for someone who's deluded. Or as Guy always says, truth for a fool.
Is that the truth for the concealer?
Yeah, truth for a concealer. Yeah, it's concealed. The real ultimate reality is concealed from you. And so you're seeing things on the level of appearances, and the level of appearances is the conventional truth. It works when it's valid. It's not really valid that a turtle has a mustache. That's non-existent. But a lot of things in the conventional level are very valid. We can build dams, we can build buildings, we can go to work, we can have democracy, we can have a court system, we can label people and put them into prison for a certain amount of time. We can pay our taxes, or we can evade our taxes. So these are things that are happening on a conventional level. But they actually are false in that they don't exist the way they appear. And that's the thing we want to come back to. That's the kind of the take-home message of the day, is how things appear to us is actually not how they exist. So, you know, and it's not really hard to find this in your own experience. Anger is, I think, the easiest one to look at for a lot of things, because it's so uncomfortable you'll take the time to look at it, you know, because it's miserable. But, you know, you can see when you calm down how you've exaggerated the negative qualities of something. Or, like, I don't know, this example works for me quite well. If you think about Miss America and you think that she's quite beautiful, right? Watch what your mind does when you see a person you're really attracted to. And now imagine that all their skin fell off. And they don't look so attractive, right? But now put it all back and snap! There your mind, it appears that way to you again. That's the appearance, you know? It's not really how it exists, because that beauty, you know, well, maybe it is only skin deep, but if you look too close, it's not even so beautiful up close. That's why they do all the photoshopping of the media, right? So... Pardon me?
Are you saying to let go of conditioning?
Well, I think be aware of conditioning is what I would say. Some of it you might choose to let go of, and some of it you might choose to keep. Because we are creatures of habit, and this is our great attribute, that we can train ourselves in ways where our minds are compassionate when we look at a situation, or we can train ourselves where our minds be conditioned in such a way that our minds are angry when we look at a certain situation. So it's a matter of being aware of the conditioning and the habituation, and then finding ways to discern what would be a wholesome direction to go.
Be aware of how you're reacting.
Being aware of how you're reacting is one thing, which is why having time each day for your spiritual, mental, emotional health is so important, because it's very easy to distract yourself from things, or to not really look at things. You need certain tools to look at things too sometimes. This is why we have spiritual friends and teachers and a supportive condition. It's not like, and why we have, in some people who are Buddhists would say, why we have all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, It's not like a cold universe out there where there's no one there to guide you. This is the great thing that the Buddha did. The most important benefit that we get from the Buddha are the teachings. Because in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha can't solve your problems. You can't take out a magical wand and boom, your suffering's gone. Boom, your delusion's gone. This doesn't. The belief is that we have to do that for ourselves, just like we can only strengthen our own muscles, we have to eat for ourselves. This internal transformation is our own. And so that's what Dharma practice is. That's what our spiritual practice is about. It's about transforming things that, if you take up the Buddhist worldview, from beginningless time, we've had this kind of ignorance that, this deep ignorance that doesn't really see reality right, that's like the deep level that creates all these other problems, right? And all these other problems is usually where we're working on things. But as we clear up a lot of that, the mind gets more and more calm, and then you can start going, penetrating into things more. And we need a lot of guidance with that. And we need teachings that are reliable, that work. And so, another point, because there's a lot of new people here today, so I think it's important to say that one of the wonderful things that I find in the Buddhist tradition is that the Buddha said, don't believe it just because I said. You need to check these things out for yourself. And actually, if you just believe it because somebody says it, it's actually not going to work. It might work temporarily, but it's not really going to penetrate. Our psyche and our being is very complex. It takes, even with anger, which is something that's more gross, you have to work on it a lot of different ways. It's like if all you have is a hammer, you see. If all you have is a hammer, you see. If all you, what is that? You see every.
Hmm.
If all you see is a nail, all you have is a hammer or something. You need a lot of tools. It comes down to that. You need a big toolkit to work with your mind. And so even with something as gross as anger, there's many, many ways to kind of undermine that appearance in the mind. Okay, so now we think we have a little bit of background, so we can talk about the chapter a little bit more. So Venerable's chapter is very well written, and it's very, it's not a beginner's chapter, I would say, having read it. But she writes so well that I think that it's, anyone could read it and get quite a good understanding of it. So when she talks about whatever appears is your own mind, that was the first line. This verse, of course, is talking about the ultimate nature of reality. And so it says, whatever appears is your own mind, your mind from the start was free from fabricated extremes. That means that from our mind and all phenomena, everything is free from this fabricated extremes. And the basis of that is free from inherent existence that we're talking about. This independent existence that things don't depend on any other factors. They exist on their own without any relationship to anything else. There's actually nothing that exists that way. But we see things that way. So when it appears to our mind, and then so things actually appear even to our senses that way, and then we assent to that appearance. We like, yeah, they really are a jerk. You know, it's more subtle than that. But you know, first there's a certain level of, wow, this kind of is unpleasant and appears this way to me. And then there's like, yeah. Or I remember this once, and I asked Geshe Tekchok this. I used to go to a lot of symphony music and classical music, and I'd be listening to it. And first there's just the pleasure of enjoying it. And then there's grasping onto, like, I want to own that CD. there's this level of just experiencing the music, and this level of enjoyment. And then there's sometimes a moment will come where your mind just grasps at it, like, that's really pleasurable, and I want to hold on to it, as if it's going to give me pleasure all the time. This is that shift that you... I asked him that exact question. Is this what you're talking about when you go from one to the other? And he said, yes. And so it's maybe a gross example, but it's something that I could understand from my own experience, because I've gone to a lot of concerts, you know, where you're more able to sometimes watch your mind, because it's that kind of music is sometimes a little more quiet. I don't know what to say. I don't think I could do it with hip-hop or with rap or a lot of really up music. You know, my mind would be in a different place. But sometimes with classical music, it has that kind of meditative aspect. So we forget that things arise dependently and that they're not isolated from other factors, which is what the meditation was about this morning. So I think we've described that, but what we haven't made really clear is that this thing about them, you know, things depend on causes and conditions, they depend on their parts, you know, you have to have all the parts to have a table. You can't just have a table without any legs, it wouldn't be a table, right? Things need their parts. But then there's how we conceive and label them, and labeling is quite a subtle thing. It's not like putting a label on a soup can kind of label. It's more subtle labeling than that. But so so she actually says, in fact, these things that we label, they exist by being merely labeled by mind. And that's really hard for us to understand. And it's very important to understand that it doesn't mean that things literally are our mind. It's that we label things and we make them into what they are, and then we forget we've done that. You know, I think that... things exist in relationship to the mind that is perceiving them. But we see them as objective entities out there, unrelated to our mind. You know, that's how we see things. That's that appearance. Okay. So, all these things that we might label, they have their parts, the thing that make them up, all the parts that make up something like a table or whatever. Independence on that, the mind conceives and labels objects. There has to be something there. You can't have an emptiness of nothing. You know, the emptiness has to be an emptiness of something. So everything has its emptiness. There's the emptiness of the clock, there's the emptiness of the recorder, there's the emptiness of you, emptiness of me, emptiness of the person that I label myself, the emptiness of my bones, my body, my mind, everything. And yeah, okay. But we don't see it that way. They all seem to be on their own. So this thing about how we perceive and label things, I want to just give a couple of examples. Like she brought up M.C. Escher. I find it a little easier to use this kind of drawing. What do you perceive? A duck. What do you perceive?
A rabbit.
A rabbit. Right? They're both there. It's what you're perceiving. Or this one. It's called the nectar cube. Do you perceive that the cubes are coming out towards you or going in? You have to might pass this one around. Pass this around. So they appear as different objects, that rabbit and the duck, right? But that's actually how our mind is just taking the sensory data and churning it, right? And that's exactly the same idea with kind of everything. We have the sensory data that comes in. We conceptualize an object. That's kind of the point. And that's not a problem. That's how we function in the world. We need to function that way. But sometimes we forget that we've done that and we think things exist in their own right. For instance, how about property line skirmishes? I think that's a very good example. Where is the property line? People have to go to court over this because, you know, you build your fence there and then it's over 3 feet or 7 feet too far and you think it's there, they think it's there. You go out to the ground, do you see anything that's inherently my property and your property? No, all you see is a bunch of dirt and somebody put their fence in the right place or the wrong place, depending on how you see it. No. But if you are the person who owns that property and it's 3 feet over the other way and your property just got smaller, you're wrong. This is mine. I label it this way and I'm right. Right? And from its own side, the property is like that. Right? This is kind of what we're trying to get at. It's good to use kind of gross examples. She used the example of a table. Our mind creates an object such as a table in the sense that on the basis of seeing these four legs and this top, we label table. And that can go right over your head. But if you bring up something like a property skirmish or being, you know, if somebody mistook you for someone else and you got life without parole, that label would be quite important to you, right? It wouldn't just be a label. It would be, here I am for the rest of my life. And I was innocent. You know, that happens. Okay. So the basic problem here is that although everything exists by merely being labeled, we perceive things to have their own independent essence, including who I am. Including who I am as a person. And that's why she got the chapter, Who Am I? Right? Okay, so if we look at who am I? We get the sense that there's something inside there that's me. Right? It's really hard to get rid of that sense. You know, like even when I do the meditation on this, sometimes I have this little voice inside, you can't find me, but I'm here. You know, because you're trying to, like, in the meditation that we do on that, say, for example, let's say you're quite mad. This is, actually works quite well. If you're angry and you know it and you're used to meditating, you can actually sit down and then say, who's angry? And then you can look. Okay, is it my hand that's angry? I don't think so. Is it I go through the systems approach to anatomy. Is it the circulatory system that's angry? No. Is it my nervous system, these nerves, the actual anatomy that's angry? No. Is my brain angry? I don't think so. It's just a bunch of molecules. I don't think the molecules are very angry. Do you? I don't think so. You might have some chemical reactions going on that are, you know, all a part of this phenomena. But so when we get to this place where we're doing this, what happens you can't actually find that person in there. Like, you look through your whole body, you're not going to find it in the parts. So then you start looking in your mind, and is the angry person the one who is dreaming, or is it the one who is remembering the incident, or is it the mind that's all aggressive, or where's the angry person? But still, if you look closely, for me what happens is there's this little voice in there that goes, "You can't find me, but here I am." I haven't gotten beyond that. Can't find it? I used to have this thing that was from my family. Oh yeah, families. You can't live with them, and you can't live without them. It's like the same thing. Can't find you, I can't get rid of you. there it is. Okay. But because we have that sense, then we pile all this stuff on that, because that person in there needs to be protected. That person is the center of the universe. See, we, in the word for this grasping at the self, has a best friend named self-centered thought, and everything in the world revolves around that being. So they're like best buddies, right? If you didn't have that first one, if you didn't have that sense of self so strongly, you wouldn't be able to hold up this self-centered thought. You couldn't think that you're the most important person of 7 billion people. You know what I mean? It wouldn't be able to... I mean, logically, you can't even make it hold up, right? But in the moment, when things are charged, of course, I'm most important, and so are you to yourself, right? So, but it doesn't hold up logically, and it doesn't hold up. So why we do this meditation a lot is we want to free ourselves from all these sufferings that we have. And this is the way to go about it. We do it at kind of a level. I do it. I think anger is a great level. It's the level I'm working with, you know. Who am I protecting? Who am I defending here? Is there some independent? It feels like there's something independent there, separate from everything else sometimes, you know. So our ignorance, this ignorance that's so active, that's what it's perceiving. That's this object that you're actually trying to get rid of. And so a lot of times, when you want to free yourself from some of these negative emotions, it might just be good to sit down, you know, calm your mind a little bit, get to a certain level of calm and say, who's angry here, you know? Or, you know, what's the problem? What really happened? Sound waves came towards my ears. I mixed them up with all my past experiences. And what came out? You know, it's like a mishmash. You can fill in a lot of blanks. There's so much going on a lot of times, which is why we need a daily practice so that we can... so we cannot do this. Like, say there's somebody that you don't like. This is the example she gave in the book. Say there's somebody that you don't like, and they walk into the room. You can watch negative thoughts come up in your mind. They haven't even opened their mouth. They haven't done anything. They might have even backed into the room and you haven't even seen their face. You don't know what mood they're in. You don't know anything. But because you have this preconceived notion, because you have this sense of self, because you need to protect that sense of self, because all these things are, like, you know, going on, this negative thought comes up. And when you meditate, you start to see all these negative thoughts. It kind of gets, at first, when you haven't learned how to work with them, it's challenging. You see your thoughts and you see things about yourself that are quite challenging. But as you learn to work with them, it's great. Because when you see them, it's like pride is like that. Pride is hard to recognize. If you live here, you will learn how to recognize your pride. And you will see it instead of like something that makes you like have like low self-esteem and shameful and you want to just like slink into the ground. Later, as you learn how to work with it, you're going to see, great, I'm glad I'm aware of that. It's like this burden that I'm carrying, and I want to, like you're carrying around a 50-pound backpack of pride, and I get to set it down now because I see it. That's kind of how it goes with these negative emotions. So when Harry comes into the room, and you think there's this solid, inherently existent jerk Harry, then they don't have to do anything, and your mind's already going, and then the adrenaline goes, and then... You know, if you're really not on the ball, you're going to create all the causes to create, for your mind to get angry, then for it to go into your behavior, and you're going to do actions, which we call karma, right? Actions. And then you're, in the Buddhist worldview, you're going to create conditions You've just created the cause by doing these unwholesome actions for your own suffering. That's what the Buddha said. And the Buddha became enlightened. What did he figure out? He figured out how suffering arises and how to get rid of it. And what he saw was that, wow, look at all these unwholesome actions that people do. He went backwards. He didn't say, this is good and this is bad. He said, the result here is suffering. What caused it? That's unwholesome. The result here is happiness. What caused it? That's virtuous. Right? It didn't go from, this is inherently good and this is inherently bad. It went from, he saw what led to suffering. And he labeled the causes of that unwholesome, non-virtuous, destructive, negative, I don't use that word so much, whatever, okay? Okay, so we got through the first couple lines. The last lines are, let's see. Understanding this, do not take to mind inherent signs of subject and object. So the subject here is the perceiving mind, and the object is the thing that you're perceiving. So we want to be aware that neither the subject, this perceiving mind, or the object has inherent existence. It's not independent of all other factors. It exists depending on other factors. It exists, that's something that's like functioning like that. Depends on causes and conditions. It depends on parts. It depends on conceiving and labeling. So if you try to find your mind, good luck. It's a flow, right? It's these moments of clarity and awareness that are in like a stream, like a river. When you try to say there's this inherently existent mind, it's like saying there's an inherently existent river. Where is the river? You know, when you look at the river, it looks like it's right there, and you can come back tomorrow at the same time, and it looks like it's right there. But everything in that river moved by, right? It's the same with your mind. It's a continuum of moments of clarity and awareness. So although we like to think, this is just how I am, this is just who I am, this is what my mind is like, I've got anger and that's me, and if you open me up you'd find it inside because I'm just an angry person. I have an angry mind and it inherently exists. You'll never find that because it's not there. It's like going back to that river. Hey, you had moments of mind, they were exaggerating the negative qualities of something, we label this anger, that's an angry mind, that's an angry state of mind. And when you come back a day later and you look at it, you can't even, you can kind of remember these things, but it's not the same. Your mind is a continuum. So we think of our mind sometimes as inherently existent too, and that's quite limiting, right? If you can't, just anger is a great example. We don't have anger buried into us that we're just going to like open up and like, ah, I'm horrible, I better close it. That's what Carl, who was that? This kind of disturbed my mind, actually. What's his name? That psychologist.
Jung.
He said to somebody, this guy came to him, he told him his story, his dreams. He sent him home. He said, I don't think we should open this can of worms. maybe the tools he had weren't going to work for this guy, so it was maybe skillful. But for me, I always found that disturbing. You aren't going to find that in Buddhism. There's not a mental state that can't be worked with in this tradition. It's mostly a matter of us learning the skills to do it. Okay. So, did I finish the verse? Understanding this, do not take to mind inherent signs of subject and object. So this is what the great yogis are doing. When they realize emptiness, they have no sense of, I am here meditating on emptiness and I've just realized emptiness. No sense of that. These things are like fused. The perceiving mind and the object they're perceiving are like fused. They say like, water being poured into water. There's no sense of I'm here realizing emptiness. And if you think you're doing that, you haven't done it. That's why we study, because you might think you have, but you haven't. Okay. So that's what is meant by do not take to mind inherent signs of subject and object. Okay, I'm just going to read this quick story and then we'll close. And I think we'll have time to, you could talk to people in the community if you have questions. And then we'll have a discussion based on the teachings this morning that help to bring to life in our own level what we're learning about. So this is every chapter in this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, has a story or two. This one is Joyce not buying into the wrong view. Recently I had the opportunity to distinctly notice my self-grasping ignorance. You know what that is now? Self-grasping ignorance? It's that ignorance that thinks that things exist how they are appearing to you. It's grasping at them, existing with that mind of ignorance. A coworker did not support a decision I made and told me so. Immediately my anger flared up. In that moment, I appeared very solid, permanent, and independent. Her sense of self, like, I'm angry, and she's wrong. Along with the anger, the innate eye grasping had arisen in my mind. That's that sense that here I am. I had taken to mind inherent signs of subject and object. The person I was conversing with appeared very solid and permanent, an objectively existent enemy out there. This was definitely a wrong view. Thankfully, although my mind was quite disturbed, I was able to watch what was happening. I told the other person that I needed to stop the conversation and calm myself down before continuing. So I went outside and took a walk. I reviewed the process for the decision I made. I was clear that I had a good intention when I made the decision, and I tried my best to carry it through. Consequently, there was no cause for my remorse from my side. I was able to calm down, not be reactive, and go back and have a calm discussion with my coworker. By mistaking myself to be an inherently existent subject, I separated myself from the other person. See, when you find there's a me and you with that kind of separation, then you've got some problems. Because you're not able to go to we. We have a problem. No, you're the problem. You know. Although I was able to stop the afflicted reaction of my mind, I did not think at the time that the subject, me, and the object, the other person, existed in dependence upon one another. Now my goal is to train my mind to see all phenomena as a combination of appearance and the emptiness of inherent existence. We had a little more feel for that than if we had read that at the start. One time I thought I might start with the story, and I thought, I don't think so. Okay. So I think we'll stop here. And if you have questions, you might even take a moment to write them down, because I'm sure that we can find some time somewhere, lunch or after the discussion today, to address them. So thank you. We'll do the dedication prayer also on page 30. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.